Hi, everybody. Good morning. Thanks for coming, joining us. We are in Sesshin this weekend. We're doing a formal traditional retreat, some of us. If you look around the room, the ones who look a little tired and disheveled may or may not be in the Sesshin. Yesterday I talked about Zazen and also about Katagiri Roshi, our founder. This picture is up on the altar here, smiling. We're celebrating this year because Minnesota Zen Center was founded 40 years ago this December. So it's a big number. It's a big year. And we also have been in this building for 36 years ago last month. So that's something to celebrate. And at this particular session, the March session, we also remember Katagiri Roshi, who died on March 1st, 1990, 22 years ago. So on Thursday, we had a little remembering ceremony for him during the morning service. So I'm going to talk about him a little bit this morning also. One of our members, Andrea Martin. Andrea here? Good, because she'd be embarrassed if I showed. Andrea wrote this wonderful essay called Ceaseless Effort, The Life of Dainin Katagiri. And I got an advanced copy of it, and so I've been taking little pieces of it out and talking about them this retreat. It's going to be up on our website soon. But so Katagiri came to Minnesota from San Francisco. He had been the assistant at San Francisco Zen Center from 1964 to 1971. He was the assistant of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, San Francisco Zen Center. And Katagiri loved it there. And he also found some aspects of it really challenging. There's a sort of famous story about how when he was out there, he and Suzuki flew somewhere from one coast to the other. And when they were flying over the middle of the country, Suzuki pointed down outside the window and said, "That's where the real America is." And it was the late 60s in San Francisco, and Katagiri was really ready to teach what he thought of as regular people. Someone told me he wanted to teach plumbers and farmers and carpenters and regular people. So he came to Minnesota, and immediately every hippie within the five-state region and from beyond showed up, along with the regular people. But so that planted a seed with him, this idea of coming to the Midwest. There weren't any Zen centers in the Midwest at that time. And but in the Twin Cities, there were a number of small sitting groups here and there. And some of the people who had been sitting together would go out to San Francisco for retreats and sessions and things. So they knew Suzuki, and they met Katagiri, and they begged him to come to Minnesota. And one of Suzuki's priests out there was from Minnesota. His name was Reb Anderson. Some of you know him or studied with him. And Reb really encouraged him to go to Minnesota. He said, it's really beautiful there. But a lot of teachers aren't interested in going there because of the cold climate. And Tomoe-san, Katagiri's wife, remembers him saying, "If I can go, I want to go to the place where nobody wants to go. That is why I want to go to Minnesota." Lots of good things come to Minnesota that way. hospital. So he had a very generous heart. And he wanted to go where he was really needed. And he responded to the people who came out and asked him to go there. He wanted to share the Dharma with people who were hungry for it. You know, it hadn't always been easy for him in San Francisco, and it wasn't always easy for him here either. But his name, Jikai Dainen, means compassionate ocean, great patience. And although when he first received those names, those were his Dharma names, he didn't particularly care for them as a young man when he first received them. By the time he got here, I think, he understood that those were two really big names that he could grow into, and that he was growing into by the time he came here. So in December 1972, the small group of people got the incorporation papers from Minnesota Zen Center, and Katayuri moved here with his wife, Tomoy, and their two young sons. A few years later, in May 1976, the group bought this house, and after extensive renovations, they held the opening ceremony in February 1976. So it was just about exactly 36 years ago that we moved in here. So that's how long this has been our home, the Sangha's home. I've been thinking about home lately because I have a girlfriend who was telling me a few weeks ago about a project she's working on. She talked to a whole bunch of different people, many of whom were immigrants, most of whom hadn't lived in the town that they're in now always, and she would just ask them, talk to me about home. Talk to me about home. And she recorded their responses, and she got all kinds of different answers to that. Just talk to me about home. It's pretty open-ended. So think about that notion of home for a minute. You know, the more you think about it, the harder it is to pin down. You know, is it a house? And if so, which one? I tried counting the number of different houses, apartments, duplexes I'd lived in over the years, and it's somewhere in the low 20s. It never adds up to the same number twice. So is it a house? You know, if it is it the one that you live in now? Or is it the one you were raised in? The one that grandma lived in? The one you love the most? Is it the place you long for? Someone said, my home is wherever my loved ones are. I think it was Mark Twain who said, home is the place where if you go there, they have to let you in. Sometimes the first time you go to a place, you've never been there before, and you have this really strong feeling of home there. Really strong feeling of home there. So what's that? Is that a dream? So you can't pin this idea of home down. You can't point to one particular thing or idea and say, that right there, that's my true home, that's it. You know? And yet, probably every one of us in this room has a home. Probably is my guess, even though we can't say what it is. I hope you find it later. So does that remind you of anything? After I thought about home for a while, I thought, you know, that's a pretty good way of approaching the notion of no self. You know, we have this Buddhist notion that's pretty hard to think about, to imagine. You know, the first time someone talks to you about no separate self, no self, I think people either go into, well, of course there's a self, it's right here, I can feel it, it's different from that self right there. Some people go in that direction, and other people go into, that means annihilation. You know? It made me really impatient. I was one of the what are you talking about people for a long time. But if you find that idea of no self hard or difficult, maybe if you start with the idea of no home, that might make it a little bit easier. Or another one, as I said earlier, this building has been the home of this Sangha for 36 years, this Sangha, this community. And yet, that Sangha has been different every moment of that 36 years. So it's kind of a rolling idea, too. You have to stop with this at some point because you won't be able to walk out the door if you keep doing it. But there's a lot of causes and conditions that bring this moment together and bring each one of us together into this self that's appearing here right now, into this Sangha that's appearing here right now. But they continue to change. You know, you look, when you look deeper and deeper and you're trying to find something that you can definitively, permanently call a self, it's really hard. Are we talking about this person who leads retreats and wears a lot of black? You know? Are we talking about the one who was Anne and Warren's daughter and these days is more a little bit like Anne's mother? Is that the self we're talking about? Are we talking about the self we'd like other people to think we are? If I'm going to cling to a self, I think that's the one I'm going to cling to. But, you know, you can noodle around in there all you want, but I can't find her. I can't find her, that self. And yet, somebody's sitting here and has to finish this talk. You want to do that, Jim? Thank you. I appreciate it. So you can't find that self, and yet somebody's here. You know, and that's good news. You know, it's an interesting sort of mental exercise to do, to think about home and what exactly home is, or to try to find this really elusive self. But then what you need to do is just let go of those notions of home and this elusive self and just be at home right in the middle of the vagaries of this life that we're in. And if you can do that, you can find some freedom in that not knowing and some freedom in that self-conscious looking, I guess. It opens up a lot of possibilities. And you shut a lot fewer doors in your life if you can do that. In study group this spring, in our advanced study group, we're going to be studying Dogen's Mountains and Rivers Sutra. And I was writing up the class description for it, and it reminded me of a poem that Shahaku Okamura read to us when I was a Genzo A, Sishin, about 6 years ago, I think, in San Francisco. So it was a week-long Sishin, and every day he gave two Dharma talks. And one of the things that he read to us was this poem that's on the front of the bulletin. It's by Dong Po. That's his literary pseudonym. He's a 11th century Chinese poet. So he read us this poem. Regarding from one side an entire range, from another a single peak, far, near, high, low, all its parts different from others. I don't know the true face of Mount Lu, simply because I am in the mountains. Now, Mount Lu is sometimes known as a sacred mountain in Chinese lore. So that's one thing you need to know about Mount Lu. So on one level, he's saying that it's impossible to say that this one or that one or this side or this angle is the true Mount Lu. You know, every way you look at it, there's more to be known about it. Every time you climb around it, you find a new Mount Lu. You know, which one is its true face? You know, you get halfway up a path and suddenly you're looking at a completely different mountain. So you can't say. If you took one of those helicopter rides that they offer over the mountains, you would get this panoramic view of Mount Lu and all of Mount Lu's neighbors, but you still wouldn't know Mount Lu. You still wouldn't know it. I went to San Francisco years ago on a different trip, and I came back, and a friend of mine said, where were you? And I told him I'd been in San Francisco. And he said, well, did you go to such and such restaurant? And I said, no. And he said, well, then you didn't go to San Francisco. I went, dang. Dang. So one other thing that we do with Mount Lu or San Francisco or Minnesota Zen Center or all kinds of places is that we layer on top our idea of Mount Lu. You know, we put this idea of it on top. You know, so when we're thinking about Mount Lu, maybe we're thinking about one of those beautiful Chinese scroll paintings of mountains. And we have the tiny little person way down on the side. Or maybe if you were raised in the mountains, any mountains, and you hear this poem about Mount Lu, it makes you homesick, you know. So maybe Mount Lu to you means Paradise Lost. Or maybe if you're a person like me from the prairie and you hear about a mountain, you think about something that's a little strange and maybe kind of claustrophobic and scary and different, you know. But, or you think, isn't that the Mount Lu that's got that restaurant that if you don't go to that restaurant, you're not on Mount Lu? Is it Mount Lu that has a little restaurant on top? So, the other thing is about Mount Lu is that it's also used as a metaphor sometimes for enlightenment. And so the true face of Mount Lu, in one respect, is our true home. It's our true self before we have any idea of self. It's Indra's net. It's that unbelievably complicated web of life. It's the myriad dharmas dancing. So Mount Lu is also beyond anything that we can imagine. Also beyond anything we can imagine. You know, you could say that line, I don't know the true face of Mount Lu simply because I am in the mountains, means I can't know true enlightenment because I'm standing here in the weeds of my everyday life and, you know, I've got work stacked up to here on my desk and the phone is ringing and I've got dishes stacked up at home in my sink and I cannot see. I cannot see beyond that. I can't get that kind of perspective. There's a Unitarian prayer that I was trying to remember this morning, and I only got part of it, but it goes something like, days pass, and the years vanish, and we walk sightless among miracles. How beautiful is this place, and we did not know it. How something is this place, and we could not see it. And it's that kind of an idea. While we are trying to imagine Mount Lu, while we are trying to see over the stacks of paper on our desk, the days pass and the years vanish. So at the Genzo Wei, Shahaku also quoted Dogen. This is from Uji, or Being Time, his fascicle on time. And Dogen said, here was Dogen's advice, go directly into the mountains and look up at the myriad peaks around you. This is vintage Dogen. Just go into the mountains. Just go into the mountains. And Shahaku said about that, this is how we study the Dharma. We are already in the mountains, and we look around at all the peaks, and that is the way we study the Dharma, and we practice. And this entire network of mountains is our life. It is our body. So that opens it up, I think. Just go in the mountains. Don't stand around talking about, someday when my life gets easier, I'm going to go into the mountains. Or, I went to Sesshin, but my life was too crazy, and so I spent the whole Sesshin planning out next week because I knew I could. You know? When it's time for Sesshin, just go into Sesshin and look up at the mountains. That's all you need to do. And when we can do that in Sesshin, we can do that in our lives, it opens up that view and it frees us. Freeze not puts us in ice, but it makes us free so that we can see those miracles. So there's a famous saying, before I had studied Zen for 30 years, I saw mountains as mountains and waters as waters. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw mountains are not mountains and waters are not waters. But now that I've got its very substance, I am at rest. For it's just that I see mountains once again as mountains and waters once again as waters. I don't want to say a whole lot about that, except that at the end there, when he sees the waters and the mountains again, just as waters and mountains, he isn't seeing the same waters and mountains that he saw in the beginning, because they're more beautiful and more precious because of his having seen that mountains weren't mountains and waters weren't waters. By the time he comes back around to it, he sees everything that they are. You know, when he's standing over here, he still can't see the back of Mount Lu's head unless Mount Lu turns around for him. But he knows that mountains are mountains and waters are waters again. So when Katagiri was a young man, he didn't appreciate his name, Compassionate Ocean, Great Patience. And then when he was a priest in San Francisco, he ran smack up against his limitations and ideas about how people are and about how people study Zen. And instead of saying, what's wrong with these people, they aren't the kind of Zen students that we had at a Heiji monastery when I was there in Japan, he said, I really need to develop this compassion and this patience.
And so that's what he did.
And I haven't read this anywhere, or nobody said this out loud to me, but I have the feeling that he spent the rest of his life, as he was teaching the Dharma and as he was maturing as a teacher, that he also dedicated his life to living into that name, becoming an ocean of compassion, and becoming someone who had great patience. I talked to someone recently who knew him, and she really thought that was the case. She said he had unlimited patience with some of the people that he studied with here, with all of the people that he studied with here, was what she said. So we came to Minnesota, and while he was here, he was gone a lot because he visited groups and taught at other places. San Francisco at one point needed him back for a year to help them. He traveled to all kinds of places. He traveled to Nebraska. He traveled to Alaska. He went to Milwaukee, I know. He went back to California. He completed the training of 12 priests. He gave 12 priests Dharma transmission. And those 12 priests have given Dharma transmission, have completed the training for another 18 or 20 priests. So Katagiri's Dharma has spread far and wide. There are Zen centers. I started trying to list them in my mind in the Katagiri lineage. In Bemidji, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, in North Carolina, in Missouri, in Evanston, Illinois, Fort Collins, Colorado, Des Moines, Iowa, New Albany, Minnesota, that's Hokkyoji, and just outside Dorchester, Iowa, that's Rumanji Zen Center. One of Katagiri's great dreams was to open a traditional style Zen monastery where Americans could go to train as monks in the traditional way. And he wasn't able to do that in his lifetime, but one of his Dharma heirs is doing that for him. He said that was his dream, and now my life's dream is to carry that forward and make sure it's done. So that's Rumanji. And Hokkyoji, the Zen practice community that Katagiri founded, it's now its own place, and it's its own Zen community. And we go down there every September together, and we go down there a lot more often than that. Individually, I'm going in April. Tim says that Katagiri talked a lot about having a dim vision. But I think that dim vision really found its way into a lot of different places in the country and also into a lot of people's hearts. A couple of times I've been at Hokkyoji, and people will just stop by and they'll say, "Hi, I was here, 30 years ago. And here it is." And they're so happy it's still there. They are so happy it's still there. And they're so happy to see it being well taken care of. Same thing here in the Twin Cities. Katagiri opened this place, and now there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Zen centers just in town here that are run by Dharma heirs of Katagiri's, and all of them are thriving. It's a pretty amazing thing, just from one man, just from one idea. So it was a dim vision, but what a vision. What a vision. That's all you need is a dim vision, I guess. But I think that it shows that his patience was great and that his compassion was huge. It was as big as the ocean. A few years ago, I told a story in a Dharma talk, and it's a story that I got from someone who remembered it from the days of Katagiri, and so it's their my memory of their memory, and I never know, you know, how much of it is still has any relation to the real, you know, to what really happened that day. But I like it, so I'm going to tell it. So, oh, and the thing that I didn't say last time was that the teacher in the story was Katagiri. So, the students, there was a student who said, sometimes when I'm angry, I'll go and I'll sit zazen. And it helps me calm down and process my anger. And the teacher looked down and grumbled, please don't use zazen that way. Please don't use zazen that way. And your first reaction might be, why not? That sounds like a really good way to... But the student had, I think, a really narrow idea of what zazen is. And when you have a narrow idea of what zazen is, it can't help you. This is why we need teachers, actually. This is exactly why we need teachers. Because then when we start to go down this narrow little path of zazen is here to help me with my anger, you get someone to sort of pick you up by the collar and say, no, look. Take a look. There's more to it than that. So, you know, he had the idea of zazen as being sort of a self-help device. He saw his anger maybe as a big log in zazen, you know, the axe that he could use to chop through that log. But his zazen is actually Mount Lu. It's a whole lot bigger than that. It's a whole lot more interesting than that. It's a whole lot more nuanced than that. And yet I was reading a quote from him yesterday, and I don't have it with me, but it was this wonderful quote about zazen and why you should do it and everything that it will do for you. And then at the end it said, there is no explanation for this. There is no explanation for it. And then I think most of the other quotes that I read talked about not having expectations, not having any expectations. But if you just continue to do it and you sit for years and years and years and you sit with other people and you sit with a teacher, you will, I think, continue to be fascinated by it and continue to be surprised by it, even when it's boring, even when your back hurts, even if you think you can't do it another minute. One of the priests at one of the other centers here in town, I won't say who, but one of them in about 1994, I think, had her own zafu and handed it to her teacher and said, I'm not going to need this anymore because I'm never doing this again. And she had the best part of this was she had written her name on it. And so he kept that zafu. And every so often, you know, in the years that followed, he would tell people that story, and then he would look over at her and he'd smile. I think maybe all of us have a story like that that we're too embarrassed to tell, but most of us don't hand over our zafus and do it in such a public way. So anyway, after you've done zazen for a number of years, after you've had this practice, after you've given up the idea that it's going to lead you to be somebody else, maybe somebody who doesn't ever get angry, you've given up the idea that, you know, you're going to be higher than Mount Lu, you're going to be more amazing than Mount Lu. You find out that Mount Lu is more interesting and intriguing every day you spend in the mountains. every path you walk over Mount Lu, you're going to find new things. Sometimes there'll be bears, right, Ben? Is that how that goes? Sometimes they're bears?
Yes.
And maybe you can't ever say, I totally know Mount Lu, every inch of Mount Lu, but you know Mount Lu. But you know Mount Lu. Even after, from every possible angle, you've seen it. You know enough to know that you don't know when the bears are going to come out. You don't know what it's going to look like from sunset tonight. It goes from being a mountain into being something way bigger than a mountain in your mind. We make it into something way bigger than a mountain in our mind. And then it's like the Oxfording pictures. If you know the Oxfording pictures, at some point, it comes back to just being a mountain. It comes just back to being a mountain. And that's when you get to start all over again, actually. I think that's all I need to say about mountains. I think that's all I have to say about mountains and waters. But if there's anything anybody else would like to say about that, why don't you jump right in?
I'd like to say something, if I could, please.
Sure.
The things I'm kind of going through right now, I won't explain, but I kind of feel that home is built from memories, if that makes any sense like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, try the home exercise sometime. Just really try to figure out what home is. You know, I have a lot of relatives in South Dakota, and when I go to this tiny little town, it really feels like home to me. And that is so not my home. That is so not my home. And yet it is. There you go. All right, well, it's a shin, so... Oh, this one, we have a...
Oh, I just wanted to say the story about the category and the airplane. I've heard, also heard in that same story that Zuki Roshi pointed down, and said, down there, people work.
We Midwesterners are known for that. To a fault, sometimes. So, we are in Sesshin today, and so we aren't going to have tea, I'm sorry. And we aren't going to have conversation too much, but please come back next Sunday. We'll have tea enough for 2 weeks then. And we'll probably be yucky, 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 yucky. We'd love to get to meet you at that point.